Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 28th of September. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
Last week, Kev, you said, and I remember listening back, you said solstice. But it was the equinox, the autumn equinox, where the day and night are effectively equal, which is interesting. Like, you know, it's like, but it, I love this time of year when it's sort of crisp mornings and still some sun around. But the thing you were thinking of was the winter solstice, isn't it? Which is effectively the shortest day of year, which happens around the 21st. So there you go. We're now in astrological autumn. How's the weather out in Egypt right now?
29 to 30 degrees, not a cloud in the sky, and when I finish this, I'm going to the swimming pool.
Mate, don't. we're still around 16, 17 here during the day, which is actually not too bad. But I mean, you were in Switzerland and the UK last week. What did you? Was it cold? I mean, we had some good weather down in Switzerland, to be fair.
The weather was glorious, wasn't it? It was warmish. It was bloody cold at the top of that pass when we were in Switzerland, I have to say. It was like 3 degrees or something. It was crazy.
Yeah. Didn't it?
But yeah, beautiful views, fantastic views of the Matterhorn and the Mont Blanc and stuff. It was incredible. Yeah, it hasn't really sank in yet, to be honest, because it was wild, you know, it was whirlwind. But yeah, not much happening. Just been traveling, to be honest, and getting back and then trying to do a load of stuff. And here we are.
Exactly.
Market's going crazy. Mr. Trump came to the UK and left. All sorts of things happening over the Charlie Kirk thing. Yeah, so yeah, the world is changing. Worldwide. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, there's been a few news stories dominating the headlines. I think the first one on Monday was the fact that the UK, Canada, Australia and others formally recognised Palestinian statehood this week, adding obviously diplomatic weight to the UN debate. So that was an interesting one. Trump, as you said, he made a couple of statements. That the first one was related to Tylenol, paracetamol as it's known in the US, saying it was dangerous for pregnant women and hinted at some exciting news to come in the press conference. Obviously, they announced that the fact that Tylenol could potentially cause autism, but a massive study involving 2.4 million children has shown that there's actually no link between paracetamol use in pregnancy and autism, debunking that claim. So medical evidence just doesn't support what he said. I mean, do you remember during COVID when he said you could potentially try injecting bleach? What do you make of his latest statement on Tylenol and causing autism?
I think the Tylenol actually is taking the headlines, and that's unfortunate, because I think there is a lot of evidence that they're going to start picking up that a lot of these vaccines have started to cause autism. Why we had 1 in 10,000 and now we have 1 in 32 in the US, when before we didn't have any vaccines.
But do you not think that's down to the fact that there's more diagnosis because of like the people slipping into those groups?
Yeah, you could say there's a part of that. But if you look at the Amish community, which is what he was saying, they refused to have any vaccines. Before they had autism 1 in 10,000, and they still have the same level. Yeah. So, I mean, it's anecdotal evidence for sure. So it needs to be proven. But there's something we're doing that is affecting this, and we need to find out what that is. And I think the Tylenol sort of comment took away from what was really the most important thing to say, which is what the medical guy was saying. Who is it? Kennedy, who's the medical guy who was saying, there you go.
What about Trump's statement on his sort of sharp shift in tone towards Ukraine now? Obviously, we saw him lambasting Zelensky earlier in the year in the Oval Office, where he was accusing him of gambling with World War III. You know, that was quite embarrassing. But now Trump's insisting that Ukraine can reclaim some lost territory and says Russia won't resist doing so. Obviously, Moscow's fired back. You know, the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, has reiterated the opposition to Ukraine joining NATO and demanded guarantees for Russian speakers. Big mounting tension over the airspace. I don't know if you've seen that, but effectively, we saw quite a lot of Russian aircraft breaching airspace NATO over Estonia. I think they came into the airspace for about 12 minutes before being escorted out by some F-35 fighter jets. We also saw some potential drone activity. I don't know if you saw that around Copenhagen Airport, which actually locked down the Danish airspace for a good few hours this week. What do you make of this kind of testing these NATO airspace by pushing these fighter jets in?
Yeah, I haven't really been watching it closely enough to comment properly, to be honest. But I mean, I think Trump is fed up with Russia, that's for sure. Yeah, he's trying to solve the world's problems. I don't know whether that's wise or not, but it is what it is. Anyway,
Okay, let's move on to our,
let's talk about something that's amazing and involves AI.
let's move on to our guest this week. We're joined by Paul Mathewson, CEO of Amazing AI PLC, who discusses how the company is moving beyond the old buy and hold Bitcoin model with its crypto treasury 3.0 strategy. Paul explains how diversification, derivatives, and active risk management underpin the approach, alongside a revenue-driven lending arm that reduces dilution. He also touches on opportunistic acquisitions and how Amazing AI aims to deliver managed crypto exposure with built-in risk controls for investors. So, welcome to the podcast, Paul.
Thank you for the invite.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I've seen the description of Amazing AI's approach as this crypto treasury 3.0. Can you explain in simple terms how this differs from the sort of traditional buy and hold Bitcoin model, please?
Yeah, so in essence, the other crypto treasury or Bitcoin treasury companies have simply had a strategy that they love Bitcoin. Bitcoin's the only great asset out there. So they buy as much Bitcoin, they raise money, buy more Bitcoin, and that's what they do. And they think that everything goes to zero versus Bitcoin, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a quite a simple approach. But there's been a lot of investor interest due to various reasons, from regulators, restrictions to tax advantages. And there are some legitimate reasons why even the basic model makes sense. We've moved to first to crypto 2.0 in that we think that just having Bitcoin doesn't make sense, that we should diversify into multiple cryptos, and in our case a basket of five, so that it doesn't matter how good something is, we don't think it's prudent just to have one asset. So we are selecting the other great assets like Bitcoin, Ethereum, and looking at a bunch of others. So we think that's stage two, and some of the other listed crypto treasury companies have done that or starting to do it, going into Ethereum and other things. So, we think that makes sense as a second stage, and that really is 2.0. But ultimately, we believe we're 3.0, where we're going beyond just diversification to utilizing smart strategies to gain more exposure while limiting the downside at the same time. So, just going long an asset and that's all you do, again, is not what we believe is a smart long-term approach. So we're approaching it that these assets we're long-term believers in, but anything can happen. Quantum computing can hack. People have said in 2 years, quantum computing may hack Bitcoin. So what happens to you then? I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm not an expert in quantum computing, but I've had three people tell me that in the last month. In addition, the Bitcoin mining is vulnerable in a sense of, the energy use as opposed to other cryptos that don't need to do this mining and, this extensive use of electricity and other things. And also the risk that miners get, they stop. So I was told confidentially by someone that when the bombs went off in Iran recently, that half the global Bitcoin mining went down, which means that, how do you transact? How does the thing work? So, if we had a global war or we had something, a black swan event, in the end, I think it's better to have a backup. So we've decided that we will, have long-term downside exposure as well as the upside at the same time. I mean, the downside exposure is very cheap because of the general belief by crypto people that it can never go down. So, why not have a tiny insurance policy over your assets? Combined with that, having other crypto assets, as I said. So, they all have their own use case and, believers in each of them, and they're all, evangelists in their own way. But there, there are, very good use cases for Ethereum and some of the other major cryptos. So we believe, having a basket of five over the near term means that if only one goes well up or well down and we make money, we think we're taking a very prudent approach.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, before we sort of drill down into a little bit more detail on sort of the diversification, as you said, and the, how you sort of manage risks in the strategy, I want to just sort of ask you a few questions, because I've looked at your CV and it looks quite impressive. You're awarded Ernst & Young's 2007 Australian Young Entrepreneur, over 30 years finance industry experience. But just tell us how you got into the finance sector and the sort of stock market research arms.
Yeah, so I mean, I come originally from a very small country town, 25,000 people in the middle of nowhere in Australia near Melbourne. I became interested in the stock market around the age of 12 for a stock market game. I was also interested in the IT and the computer side. So I actually, as my family were quite poor, I started importing and exporting computer games. I was a little bit of a hacker, and buying and distributing computer games and selling them locally. So I was an entrepreneur at 12, and started doing my own radio ads, buying wholesale computer discs at $3 and selling, at 50 cents and selling them at $3, importing games out of UK, New Zealand, and so forth. So I was into that, but it was a means to an end because I couldn't afford to buy them. So I ended up with about 3,000 games at the age of 14.
On the Commodore Amiga and the Atari ST and all those.
Yeah, Commodore 64.
Yeah.
So if combined with, you buy this thing that you time the button, you can hack in. And anyway, it's a long, long time ago. So I used to time for all us old guys here. I used to have to dial the phone. So your younger audience wouldn't understand what that even means. And you'd have to time it, to get the number in to get the free radio ad so I could sell my product. But anyway, that's ancient history. So anyway, at 14, I started using the profits from that business to start buying stocks and options at the age of 14 in the Australian market. So the first two stocks I bought were Burswood Casino and Westpac Bank. And then I, over the next couple of years was experimenting, trading, quite liked it. Yeah. So I don't know where it came from, in a town where I think my mother today still thinks I work in a bank as a bank teller, but that was the background. So then I decided I wanted to be a stockbroker. So at the age of 15, during my school holidays, I started cold calling broking firms 3 hours ago to try to let them come and do their work experience. So out of 120 rejections, one gave me a chance. So that's where it all began. And then at the age of 19, I went to Bond University to do an accelerated degree in commerce and finance. I was ducks of every subject in finance, and you did three semesters a year. So yeah, basically I was the youngest institutional broker and analyst at Daiwa Securities in Australia, in Melbourne. I was then poached to Western Australia for 5 years, where I ran underwriting, small company research, and so forth. I was also a derivatives advisor from Macquarie Bank and others. I did a lot of things while I was doing that. I did my master's degree in applied finance, specializing in options and futures and corporate finance. And then at the age of 25, I went to ING Barings as an investment banker. After I did all that, I said, not for me. I want to do my own thing. So I quit all that, and 25 years later, I've been doing my own thing ever since.
Very good. It's a great story. I like it. So let's have a look a little bit at the sort of structure of the company as well, because obviously you've got Amazing AI sitting there as the kind of the top co with MRAL US Corporation in the US, and then Amazing AI Services now in Mauritius. So just talk us through the different arms of the company and the structure.
Yeah. So Just before I get into that, I guess I should mention that after funds management business, I set up consumer credit company in Australia, lending under Amazing Loans. And the reason I could do that was A, because I'd been exposed to the sector as an investment banker that sparked my interest. And we couldn't do the deals or get listed for those deals because they didn't meet the regulatory requirements. So I was able to sort of have a clean sheet of paper and set up my own business lending using the capital from the profits I made from all my investors in my funds management business. So yeah, we may get into the funds management business side in a minute. And then in 2008, I moved to the US and set up Mr. Amazing Loans, which forms the core of what we have today. So that's 100% owned by Amazing AI listed. And that's been, you know, set up in February 08 by myself, and it's been operating since 2010 and fully regulated. Yeah, we can shift back to that after this. But in terms of your question, we are using all of the experience in our core lending business in the US and Australia, and all of my history, to actually offer other lenders globally smart AI-driven machine learning systems that we've been doing since 2012 in the US.
Very good. So, Paul, you've given us your blow for blow on your background. So what was your favorite video game? Let's be honest. Let's get it on the table.
Tetris, the basic Tetris, one. Yeah. You know?
What about I remember Commodore 64. I remember Manic.
Actually, I did love Commando. I got to 1 million points in that one. If you
that was
did,
good.
Did you know that one?
Yeah. Paperboy, Manic Miner, Jet Set Willy, those.
Commando was very good.
You're all giving your age away. Time. Very good. So I want to ask about the business in the USA and the lending thing, because at the base of every good AI stroke treasury company, I believe there has to be a strong business that can produce revenues. So tell us more about the business. I mean, I see from the deck you sent me, it's sort of high interest lending, small amounts. How does it work? And it's based in Vegas, I think, from what I've read.
So getting back, we haven't really talked about, after we've got to get back into my funds manager business side as well, but let's stick to the lending for now, is that in essence, I created a brick and mortar lending business in Australia with 48 offices from zero in 2 years, basically from nothing. I'd never lent a dollar before. The first $1 million that was lent out there, I lent it myself. I was looking at people's IDs. I had a spreadsheet. It helped when their ID was from the jail ID. So, you don't give them a loan, but it was pretty raw stuff back in, 05 and 06 and so forth. So and that was called Amazing Loans. I came up with the name on my 30th birthday, after a couple of days of partying with a lot of friends. So people either hate it or they love it, but you don't forget it. Very memorable. And
that's right.
That name has continued on now with our parent company. Yeah, so
amazing. You've got a lot to live up to.
Amazing. I mean, some people think it's tacky, but again, is it better to have some random, I don't know what name, or amazing?
Yeah.
Do you want to be
well,
amazing?
Basically, you're putting yourself slightly on a pedestal and saying, I have to be amazing. So there you go.
Well, so it works. And the customers, particularly in my sector, like it. I mean, in UK, maybe it wouldn't work, with some of the people, they might like it. But, people who want small loans, they like the character that I created, Mr. Amazing Loans, with the whole character. I even have back in the day, I was doing late night TV advertising. I had and radio, again, all these things you don't do today. But we came from a old school brick and mortar approach, and then quickly adapted it to new technology, which we've done. So a lot of the new tech guys, they had great tech, but they've never lent a dollar, or they didn't come from that approach. So I came from starting with the lending, starting with the basics, and then looking about how to automate it. So long story short, I decided to expand to the US in 08, moved there. I lived there for a number of years. It wasn't going to work unless I jumped up and moved there from Australia and made it all happen. I got licensed during the global financial crisis. I started doing loans in 2010, and we've been operating ever since. So fully regulated, no issues. Yeah, that's a long history, 2010. And that, as I said, is the company that was 100% owned. We quickly were we were actually the first to move from brick and mortar. So we had actually four brick and mortar shop fronts in the US back in 11, 12. And we were able to get approval from the regulator to actually shut them down and operate fully online out of our Vegas office that still exists today, because they were comfortable that they could, well, A, they were probably happy to travel to Vegas at our cost to inspect the records, which they do from the other states, but they were comfortable that we had a physical presence to justify for the other states. So we were the first to go from being traditionally regulated brick and mortar to fully online, effectively. And that's way back in 2012, which is a long time ago. And we also, at the same time, started doing innovative machine learning processes that people call AI today. But in fact, we were doing a lot of it back in 2012. And we initiated that no customers could get approved for a loan unless they gave us access to their bank statement, which is the whole open banking profile of today, which has only just started in 2020 in UK, Australia, 2022 in Philippines. It's about to start in Nigeria as the first in Africa, which is why we're interested there. And Middle East, I think, are looking at it. And you know, I don't even think Canada have it yet. So, you know, when a lot of these companies get excited about open banking, it sort of was a surprise to me. But that's why I guess I saw an opportunity to list our company in UK and take advantage of that trend and that interest. One of the groups we've been dealing with has raised £2 billion of funding simply because they started open banking in 2020. So it's obviously an interest in it.
So what size of book is in that business then, you know, in terms of lending criteria?
Yeah, so our loan book in the US, we at one point had lent out $17 million. We'd had a family office that had provided us a funding line and so forth. Unfortunately, they blew up their other investments and the lawyers came in and basically wound down all their other customers. So we were forced to sort of wind the book down. I have since kept that business fairly relatively dormant, waiting to expand at the right time with the right funder. So what I've done is put in place my own personal funding in the last couple of months. So I've provided my own personal funding line of £5 million. So shortly I'll be ramping that business up significantly without worrying about, you know, a creditor pulling the rug out from under us as such. So I'd gone, you know, over the years, the only issues we'd ever had was funders. They always love the business too much, want all the profit. And then if it's too good, they want to steal the whole thing and all the equity. So, you know, it's hard to explain to, I guess, mums and dads that, you know, the banks don't steal their house. But in the commercial, well, sometimes they do, but not in a commercial aspect, you know, you can be too good as well. The margin can be too good. The performance can be too good. So, you know, the covenants in loan agreements are often basically in the bank's favor. I mean, if anyone read their mortgage, they'd be horrified if they understood the rights that a bank has to call up their loan or a business or whatever. I mean, it's really discretionary.
Be debt-free. So what sort of...
Be debt-free, which is exactly what I am today and what the company is. And except I've put in place a $5 million debt facility that's currently undrawn, and soon we'll be starting to draw down and utilizing those funds at 59.9%.
So what rate of interest do you pay, or will the company pay for your £5 million loan?
Yeah, so the company will earn 59.9%. My current arrangement is 2% a month, but my view is that I give the company that foundation to ramp it up without having to worry about having the funds called up. And once we get to a certain scale, then hopefully we can get a debt fund that isn't too egregious and refinances my loan at a, you know, at a 10% or 15% rate, you know, a normal bank or someone who doesn't actually want to take your business. I mean, so the key is in these deals is, you know, if you can actually scale it enough to get to a lender who's not interested in owning your business, that's the nirvana.
That's the good plan.
But it's easier said than done. But
if you're lending at close to 60%, then you're going to have a 30% margin, I presume, after after that. So do you envisage, and this is the question I'm trying to get at, do you envisage that the running of Amazing AI, all of the costs of the top co will be able to be covered by this funding company?
Well covered. So,
yeah.
And
you expect going forward?
Even $1 million drawdown, couple of million drawdown is sort of covers everything.
Okay, very good. Very good. Okay, so let's move back. Let's jump back and tell us how you managed to do things in the investment arena that has then brought us now that you can think about doing these call put option type scenarios for crypto.
Yeah, sure. So getting back to my background at 14, trading options and futures, I was quite interested even way back then, in the potential upside and the volatilities, and learned quite a lot around that. I mean, I was actually, believe it or not, at 14 writing covered call strategies and doing spreads and strangles way back then, totally self-taught. And then in my master's degree, I specialized in options and futures. At Hogan & Partners, where I was head of research and corporate advisor, I was the representative. I was advising 30 dealers, but Macquarie Bank had a structured derivative product that I was the representative or writing research to try to get our retail investors to invest and our dealers and so forth. So Macquarie would be happy taking me out and all of that, obviously, to get us to look at their products. I was an accredited derivative advisor with the Australian Stock Exchange. So in addition to that, so I had to go through all of those aspects. So I had a very strong interest and experience in options and futures from a long time ago. What interested me and what I discovered was around the age of 25, when I quit investment banking and said, I want to do my own thing. I don't want to be bossed around. I want to be the CEO. I looked at the structure of a protected equity loan. For those who understand options, you buy the stocks, you take a loan at it to give you the leverage, and then you protect against it with put options. So you don't blow up. Now, Macquarie Bank at the time were offering a product for $200,000 that would give you $500,000 of exposure to the actual stocks. So, you were getting decent upside, but not great. So we were sort of promoting that when I was a broker, an analyst. So I basically said, well, I think there's a better way of doing it. Let's use straight long-dated call options that replicates the same exact payoff like this. So the other one goes flat like that and with a premium cost. And in essence, I was able to create a product that was being sold in the marketplace for 200,000 Aussie for 50,000 for exactly the same payoff to an investor.
So you were producing reverse hockey sticks as well as hockey sticks.
Exactly. But all through doing it, because I didn't need to, chip out 100,000 from Macquarie Bank's overhead. And B, I did it smarter because I wasn't paying for the extra premiums of lending or, I went to the core. Now, while that may sound simple, those 5-year call options weren't available. So while someone could say, oh, that's a great idea, you couldn't actually buy what I was doing. So I had to get those 5-year call options created in the first place, to get people to sell them to me. And the only way I could do that was via my connections first, but secondly, by volume. So there was no way of someone, that's a fantastic idea, which is why Macquarie Bank could charge 200,000 because you couldn't actually do it. So I was able to create that. But the only way I could do that was run around. I was doing seminars and so forth and convince enough people, which is sort of like deja vu today with Amazing AI and crypto, to believe in what I was doing because no one had done it. And so I managed to scramble together about 5 people to do the first deal. So, we had like 250,000 and I put that first position in place. Those people 3 years later made 500% and I sold their position out and they're still shareholders today. I think 3 or 4 of them out of those 5.
Very good.
Harold, Paul, I can name them. I won't name their surnames, but I know this. So they've been, that's way back in a long time ago. So that was, that was pretty hard work. And it was the Iraq War at the time when it was sort of some of this was happening, and no one wanted to know about anything. They're in their bunkers, which hopefully won't be, hopefully that's not deja vu today as well, with the way the world's going. But I created that, and then once I started, I went around and got it, convinced enough people, we did it for a couple of years, and in effect, I raised enough money, did it, and everyone made 500%. Happy days. But the one thing about it is I did back test the strategy over 20 years, and it never lost money on any day you did it. It averaged 500%, and the top returns were multi-thousand percents, depending on when you went in. So it wasn't like some guesswork. It was a basically offering something that Macquarie Bank and others were doing much, much cheaper for starters, but also back testing it, using Black and Scholes and everything that I was, sort of lived and breathed. So the good thing about that is all those funds, I mean, were then redirected to give me the capacity to, well, could have retired, but to set up my lending business, which I did, and also give me a core base of shareholders that have backed me for 20 years. So we have that who really understand what we're now doing now. I mean, they sort of laugh, but you've come full circle, back to where we're at.
So Paul, how does that, I mean, I was trying to do a bit of research into the whole derivatives market in terms of Bitcoin, and it's obviously not small. I mean, you've got Deribit, you've got OKX, you've got Binance, you've got Delta Exchange, and from the information I've seen, you're looking at a market that is well established, in terms of at the minute somewhere in the region of $60 billion worth of options, or $50 billion anyway. So how is what you did in the past going to be able to translate to both the Bitcoin side of things and also maybe Ethereum? Again, they're the two biggest markets by the looks of things. You're looking at 20, 30 billion in terms of Ethereum, I think it is. About 15 billion. But are those options available for 3 to 5 year options?
They are available at scale, but you need scale, which is the key. And I've had quotes from, I won't get into who, but some of those names you've mentioned. And we're going to, we don't want to have the market front run us by getting into too much exact
Yeah, I
specific
don't
info.
want details. It's more just you don't have to go and create it all over again.
But in essence, it's, yeah. So there's enough liquidity that there's quotes. I mean, I've got quotes from, one of the, $3 billion company, UK company, for instance, to give an example. And the biggest derivative trader in crypto, in the world. The issue will be, again, probably spreading between even some of those guys, so they don't, get too greedy on their option premiums and so forth. There's angles around that. But I think the interesting thing is that just like 25 years ago, the option sellers, when I first wanted to buy, those options didn't even exist. So they're going, why would you even want a 5-year option? Because the actual normal derivative trade is all about the next 5 seconds.
Yes, indeed.
They're about their bonus for the end of the year. So I was able to take advantage of that, the mispricing. And actually, I was offered to do a PhD at university to prove the mispricing of Black and Scholes for long-dated options. So it was sort of, I mean, there's a mispricing, but it's a mispricing due to natural forces. I mean, again, a trader today, his bonus, where are we? September? Does he care about 5 years from now? It's not going to be there. And he can sell me long-dated options and book the premium and put it in his bonus check, a big portion of it, and no one's really going to know. I mean, it's all subject to volatility assumptions, interest rate assumptions, the future price. Anyone who understands Black and Scholes, I mean, it's pretty variable. You can come up with an option price between 40 cents, 20 cents, and a dollar, depending on who's doing it. So I used to enjoy buying the options sort of Christmas Eve from the work exchange student, pretty much like I was back in 15 or 16, and then you'd get them for half price because
They need the money for the Christmas drinks, yeah.
as if they care or even
Oh,
know.
is there
He's
a
probably come out of his Christmas party and quote the options.
so
So
is there a time, because we're just about to come to a option cliff, if you like, every quarter where it drops. So is there a specific time where you can think, okay, this is the time for me to get in and quotes on these things? Is it at
well,
the
there's definitely times, but we won't, the witching hours and, the triple witching and all of those things. But, we're not, I don't want to give it too much of the secret sauce away, Kevin. Just like Coca-Cola doesn't tell you what that secret
I
ingredient they
understand.
have in Coke that gives you that kick, if you know
Okay,
what I mean.
so in terms of assets in this, Bitcoin obviously is going to play a major role. Ethereum, from what you've said, a major role. What other assets are you considering, even if you don't think you're going to use them?
Look, it's as per our announcement, and we have to be juggle through all the hoops out there. I think I said in an interview the other day, I'm like hopping around on one leg with two arms tied behind my back. So, the current policy of the stock markets are that you can only have, as if you read our RNS, the exact specifics, certain size, certain volumes for now. I think that may change over time. So we're constrained by those aspects. So you can look up the major ones. Before we sort of publicly come out and comment, we've been very careful in everything we do. So we had full legal sign-off before implementing this strategy that we could do, the Bitcoin and Ethereum. So before we publicly announce sort of the other asset classes, we just need to do a bit of back-end work. But I mean, you can look at it yourself. Under those criteria, it'll be the major groups with interesting different aspects. I mean, there's potential for, a gold-linked crypto so that, the gold bugs can get their excitement as well. I particularly like that. I've been involved with Stellar in the past, in if we get into my background around crypto before. So I think that's a very good one in terms of actual remittances and transferring money. And there's various groups. I mean, if Donald's listening, we may even add his.
You're gonna buy
Yeah.
his coin. Okay, possibly, maybe, sort of, if anybody's listening.
That's a bit of a joke, but you
That
never know.
you're currently sitting in a market capitalization of £5 million with, I presume, £1 million plus in the bank from the last raise. What is your expectations? If I'm gonna be interviewing you in a year's time, what is your hope for amazing AI?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm the major shareholder. I've never sold one share. I own 38.1%. I've just provided a $5 million debt facility that basically equal to our market cap. I'm independently quite wealthy. I have no debt. Company has no debt. So, in my view, it's all upside from here. So, it's about execution, but I think the returns that I had in my funds management business can be much, much higher in the crypto space because, back then, you're talking about, long-term blue chip Australian stocks, and I could still make 500% over 5 years. Whereas here we're talking about markets that people can't get access to. They're very new. Their upside is much, much greater. So, I would hate to think that I'm not achieving at least what I've done in the past. And, I think once people understand, or once the results come out of these strategies, then I think the stock would be much, much higher. I mean, if you look at Treasury 1.0, without bagging those guys out, I mean, companies went to $1 billion in 4 months. So, using a very basic strategy. So we're at 5 million. Extremely tight shareholder structure, with a centerpiece of myself, but then most of the other shareholders are long-term Australian backers of me for 20 years who've made money in this sort of strategy. So, they obviously understand it. So I don't think, most of them don't even have, they have their share certificates sitting at home. They haven't converted them. So But
Yeah. So what?
there's no stop coming out of there.
Yeah. So what is the situation in terms of what would give the best return? So is it that actually, cryptos will crash, that would give you the best return, or cryptos, basically just steadily go up? Everybody's talking about, in a year's time, Bitcoin could be $250,000, could be $180,000, could be $120,000. Not many people are saying it could be $50,000 now, and maybe that's why the options are going to be cheap.
Oh, they're very, very cheap. But I think, I mean, the best outcome is always if things go up. So, I mean, if you look at, I was just in Hong Kong a few weeks ago with Trump's son, and he's totally convinced it's going to 1 million in 2 years. Now, he's the good thing he has is his father makes the rules and changes the regulations. So, and he was incredibly confident, I must say. he does have an advantage. But I mean, if Bitcoin went to 1 million in 5 years, which isn't out of the question with new institutional funds and everything else, then, to give you a very broad strokes idea, for every 1 million of capital I could deploy, we would make around 70 million profit. So
Okay.
that would be happy days at those sort of levels.
Okay, very good.
Good. Well, Paul, obviously you're on the roast, and this is a completely different question now, but what is the perfect roast in the Matheson household?
Nearly every Sunday is chicken roast, chicken
That's a
breast
good one.
roast with some nice carrots. And I actually just had that last night, believe it or
Oh,
not.
you went for the midweek. What version did you? So
Yeah,
would you have
not even a Sunday roast. So yeah,
yeah.
it's a bit of garlic, bit of organic straw tomato. So yeah, that is
Very
the
good.
perfect one.
I was expecting lamb from the Australian Outback boys.
Yeah, look, I don't mind a bit of lamb. It's a bit more harder work to roast it. Chicken's a bit easier. The lamb chops are good. So yeah, but chicken is the go-to.
And if you're not
What
working,
about yourself?
my final question, Paul, for you would be, why do this through a company, and why not just do it yourself?
Yeah, so people ask that, and I obviously could do it myself, but the upside in having a listed vehicle and the potential that I could have, 100 million or 1 billion under management in this strategy in the next short term is worth the effort. If I had, 100 million, let's say if I had 10 million of raising in this vehicle, for instance, and deployed it, I could have that gives me 1 billion exposure to the upside. If I have 100 million, which isn't out of the question, that's 10 billion. So I probably can't do that myself. So
Yeah, I
that
understand.
becomes worthwhile. So, but yeah, at 1 million, I could, this sort of levels, yes. But I think, I also have my long-term shareholders that I have to look after. So, if I didn't have any shareholders, I probably wouldn't do this, to be fair. But I have a long-term supporter base of 20 years. They're excited at the upside.
Very good. Well, we're going to be watching you, cheering you on, and hopefully it's going to be successful. It's going to be amazing.
Going to be amazing, yeah. The objectives.
I'll have to roll. We actually have a suit in Vegas for you, Kevin. We
Okay.
have the Mr. Amazing suit.
I'll be there. Book
Should
the
we
ticket. I'll come and
get
wear
them to
Mr.
courier it
Amazing
over
ticket.
for you?
When you're 100 million market cap, I'm on the way, okay?
Good.
Excellent.
Okay. On that note, we'll say Paul Mathieson, CEO of Amazing AI. Thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
So let's move on to our second guest this week. Ricana is a fast-growing energy intelligence company positioning itself as a world's chief energy officer. Using a proprietary iPad-sized gateway device and a powerful SaaS platform, it delivers real-time device-level analytics to help businesses cut energy bills, improve operational efficiency, and comply with ESG reporting. Clients already include global names like McDonald's India, DP World, and Aramco, with contracts typically running for 5 years and an average 25% energy cost reduction within 3 months. Recana combines recurring SaaS revenues, a rapidly expanding data lake, and deep customer entrenchment. The company is targeting over £50 million EBITDA by 2030, with a current total addressable market of $8.6 billion across sectors from data centers to mosques, shopping malls, and ghost kitchens. Today, we're joined by the leadership team of Recana, a company redefining energy intelligence and optimization, Bill Milne, Managing Director, and Murali Arikara, Chief Technology Officer. Welcome to the podcast, gents.
Thank you.
Recana describes itself as the world's chief energy officer. For listeners who may not be familiar, can you explain, Bill, what it means in practice and how your platform helps organizations take control of their energy use?
Yes, I most certainly can. What the Recana system does is deliver information to people that they have never had visibility before. If I was to use a simple analogy, at the moment, most people with their energy probably have information that's equivalent to being given their bank statement balance at the end of the month showing how much they've spent, nothing else. What Recana does is it allows you to see by system, by every 15-minute interval, how much energy is being used and why. So on one level, that is absolutely brilliant in terms of understanding your costs and reducing them. On another level, it's not just about that. There's a level of information we give in terms of how the assets are performing. Do they need maintenance? Are they dangerous? Et cetera, et cetera. But the gateway is a gateway because it's a gateway to that level of information. And also, I would say it certainly does it for energy, but it's not just electricity. We can do similar things with gas and other utilities, including water.
Very good. Yeah. So from a commercial standpoint, as I alluded at the top there, Recana has some pretty big name clients already, you know, McDonald's India, DP World and Aramco. So what's been the key to landing and scaling with such global partners?
You really have two sides to this. Number one is actually having the great technology and being able to demonstrate that you can deliver it efficiently. And the second side to it is working with the correct partners in there. Now, most geographies in the world are different. In India, we very much used our own team and worked through. So that would be the case with McDonald's. When you look elsewhere, we have used channel partners who effectively can get us into the room with the right person. Because most people, when you tell them what our technology can do, are initially skeptical because they obviously hear the great stories. And we have to work through, convince and demonstrate. Having said that, you tend to only have to do that with one or two people in a territory. And then the word spreads for itself. And it's very much making sure. So we have different partners. We're just about to sign up with one in KSA. We have established partners in UAE and in Qatar also. And they provide the correct introductions for us and they have the right knowledge that then allows us to get in and demonstrate. And once you're there, it's a gift that keeps giving because once you prove it with 5 units, there's a capacity for 1,000 potentially with some people. And in one of the cases you mentioned, if we look at McDonald's, it's now an entire estate that we do for them. If we look at the DP World, it's the dry docks where you start with a small number. We're expanding to a larger number. And they actually then want to lock in the pricing for the rest of the site.
Very good. So I'm going to come to you, Murali, because as CTO and the inventor behind, you know, much of the IP here, how does Recana's technology differ from, you know, existing energy management systems? And obviously, I don't want you, don't give away too much of the game there, because I'm sure there's a lot of it shrouded in secrecy. But what makes it hard for competitors to replicate?
So there are two basic principles we follow. The first one is We call it intrusive data, which means we go deep, granular, and accurate. Now, it's a fairly simple statement to make, but to get to those, there's quite a bit of effort that goes in. So that's what our technology platform does. We have 4 pillars to our technology platform. One is the hardware itself. Most people outsource the hardware, they buy equipment, and then they provide their analytics and other bits on it. We actually build our own hardware. The second is the analysis or the analytics that we have. The third is the modeling capability we have. And then the fourth is the algorithms we develop. These 4 have to work hand in hand to do it. compared to our competition, that's one thing that all our customers have said is the depth of data, or the intrusive data that we call, is given them the ability to look at things that they have tried others before they have not seen. In addition to that, the model is such that we also work hand in hand with the customer. We are not there to just deploy and leave. We have our own energy analysis team that makes use of some unique algorithms, proprietary algorithms that uses a lot of AI with it, AI ML with it, that helps us actually provide some very unique insights they would have not seen otherwise. So as Bill mentioned, it's not just about energy savings, it's providing them that operational visibility that they did not have before.
Very good. Welcome, guys. Muriel, what actually does protect it? Do you have any patents on this technology?
We have not filed for patents. That's one of the things that we want to do with the funding that we get. But we have captured our intellectual property in terms of internal invention disclosures. And we have what we call a IP register that we've created. And the aim is, once we get to the next round of funding, we'll start filing these for patents.
So the reality of the tech is, what does it actually physically do? I mean, I've seen the box, but what does it actually do in simple man's terms? Because I'm not very clever, so please tell me in one syllables.
The simplest way to define it is like saying that we have a sensor or a system that measures about 16 different parameters from an electrical standpoint. So that's what gets the depth that we're looking for. It's most people usually just measure energy consumed and then they come with it. But we look at 16 different electrical parameters. So it's like connecting an ECG to every asset you have in your facility.
So you can actually go down to appliance level. So for instance, there's a dishwasher there and it's not working very well. How would you find out that it's not working very well from your data?
So we look at a bunch of parameters. First, at a first level, it's something very simple. You know that a dishwasher is supposed to consume, let's say, a kilowatt of power at a time. We have data for a whole bunch of these. We can then look and say, this is the trend normally, and this is what this particular device is doing. That's at a very simple level to look at it. Then we go into the next level where we start looking at other aspects, like what is the power factor it's operating at? That's one of the electrical aspects we look at. Then we start looking at things like harmonics that are generated when the system is running. So it gets deeper and deeper. And through those, we actually are able to identify what the characteristic. We have what I call the baseline characteristic of these systems. And then we are able to look at and say, this particular device is operating at this level. It's different from what is the baseline. And hence, we also know that when there are differences, what could be the reason these differences are. We may not be able to say exactly this is the problem, but we know there's a problem. And through the data that we've collected, we are fairly certain we can pinpoint to a pretty good degree what the problem is. And that's what the customers like.
So if you had a restaurant and you had this in, what would be the reason, other than just saving the electricity and the cost, that they would have this?
So, and that's true with the two customers in India that we have deployed hundreds of units at. What they're able to look at is several things. They know exactly when a machine comes on and when a machine goes off, which is pretty critical for them to understand how their systems are working. The next thing they understand is when there is a system that is beginning to fail, most people only realize something after it has failed. We are able to give them information that, look, there's a problem and this system is potentially going to fail. I'll give you an example. We deployed at one of our customer sites, and within the first day or two, we indicated to them that a particular device was having a problem and was malfunctioning. And this was an air conditioner. And they said, no, the air conditioner is maintaining its temperature, its taking care of everything. We said, that's true, but there is a problem with it. It could fail at any point. What they realized when they went and inspected it was one of the fans on the outdoor unit had failed. And hence, the system was consuming a lot more power, which meant that the compressor in the air conditioner was running overtime, which could result in a failure of that system. So So we were able to actually prevent that from happening, but that also resulted in a reduction of their energy. So that was one of the interesting pieces. The other one we do is also monitor temperature in their freezers, which allows them to know exactly what's happening with their food that is being stored. So in addition to the power, we also look at that and we correlate those with how the power is being consumed. And with that, we are able to know what's the health of the freezer. So give you an example, one of the customers, we were at that point of time at 50 of their outlets. We were able to show them by comparing the what we call walk-in freezers that about 14 of them had a problem. And the problem was very simple. It's that the seals on the doors had failed and they were leaking energy out. And by just fixing the seals, they were able to significantly reduce the energy consumption on this.
So it's not only an energy saving, it's also almost a maintenance device for customers. You can almost alert them to an issue with, as you say, an air conditioner or a freezer that's working at not at optimum operating efficiency.
Yes.
Absolutely. And if I may, this has further practical applications. And I love to say that Recana is a brilliant information system. And sometimes it's up to the customer. So there's one customer we've worked with, we're working with, and they're looking at doing stuff where one of their things was they held government vaccines in a fridge. The fridge dropped to zero. They had a $9 million write-off. And I still remember the CTO's first question. Could you turn my fridge off if it got to 2 degrees centigrade? Then turn it back on for me and let me know to get the engineers out. And because of what our system does, it doesn't just monitor, we can automate things. So we could set the rules to do that, to say, it turns off at 2 degrees. By the way, we've sent a note to you, the engineers, and here's a copy of it. And that was for the chief operating officer. So you can ultimately say that if business is about risk of delivering everything efficiently, this gives you information to deliver efficiently for what your risks are. Cost is an easy one that people understand, but there might be other things where being able to sleep at night, not worrying about a cataclysmic event, is very, very powerful for people.
Yeah, I can see the safety aspect would be very important for people as well. So what you mentioned Saudi Arabia, you mentioned India. From where and what purposes do you see this being installed? And I suppose the bigger global question is, how do you get to the financial predictions that we saw, you know, 2025, there's a small loss, 2026, you're talking about 7.5 million EBIT, 2027, 29 million, 2028, you know, it continues to go up and the long-term target is to have 50 million. What number of units do you need to achieve those objectives? Subsequently, who do you think is going to take them? Like, we've got McDonald's worldwide, obviously. I mean, if you put them all in McDonald's worldwide, you'd have many, many thousands of units.
Well, the actual answer to that question is almost fairly multifold. So if I can break it down into certain areas. Firstly, you look at the customer base. Now, one of the reasons for the Middle East is that typically for most businesses out there who aren't manufacturing, say office-based businesses, up to 80% of their cost can be air conditioning. It's not controlled and automated, managed between temperatures and turned off when it's not needed. So to generate savings in certain areas up to 40, 50% is relatively easy. So you have that as an entire market that you can look at, you know, within properties and offices. We can then move on to, you touched on the mosques before. Mosques are something where typically you pray for 5 times a day. But beyond that, how do you control the power supply outside that? If you can manage that and then give warnings about anything going wrong, and the market size there alone is 6 figures within the greater Gulf area of those 3 countries, comfortably over 6 figures is an addressable market. And we haven't even mentioned here manufacturing, where you might not automate, but information. The average manufacturers might spend 40% of their cost on compressors. They don't know if they're using efficient ones. They don't know if these things are running far too many hours than they should do. Because a compressor should build up a head of steam, quite literally, and then not be used again. But it might be running because of things like leaky airlines, et cetera, et cetera. There's all of those opportunities. And what we have been able to do is we've been quite ambitious with the customer base we've gone to. There's no point in selling these in penny numbers. That's why, for example, we've worked with Aramco and we've got the reference of them. We're looking at sort of the strategic partners in KSA who will deliver large numbers. It's very similar both within Qatar and also within Dubai as well. For the people we're working with, we have supermarket chains, et cetera, et cetera. So I have no great difficulty. And the beauty of the model is what we've done internally is we've looked at the efficient delivery and deployment of the unit to build that, which is one element that actually we're very, very good at. We actually have, as a shareholder and the person who's helping us with contract manufacture, the ex-VP of operations of Apple in the Middle East, who was responsible for moving the iPhone and the iMac for the production out there. And that can actually help us with manufacturing and logistics. And then we look at the actual cost of delivery, where we're talking about single digit dollars in terms of hosting information and providing reports per site. So for every site where you're going to charge at least a couple of $100 a month, you can suddenly see what the contribution of EBITDA is. And then what you get down to is really what the sale is going to be. So once we deploy, we probably spend 75% of our effort with the customers on the first 10 units and 25 on the next 200. So that's why you can see a very quick growth, because once people see a benefit, all of a sudden then they drive towards it and they take off you. And in the case of India, it's full of states, and as they grow, it's more. And now we have their competitors saying, if they like that, we should too.
Yeah. How does it work in terms of things like insurance companies almost insisting that a company puts this in for safety reasons, you know, especially if there's fire risks or there's other risks involved?
That's not something where we've approached the insurance companies to show the benefits. One of our major challenges, I said this was a great information system and you can do lots of things. If we try to do 10 things at once, we'd fail. We have focused deliberately with customers where they have specific needs and they have specific volumes, and we can then lead and develop in. So effectively, what you've asked there is another opportunity with development, where if we show this capability and its protection, and it's very real. We have another customer where we've shown there's a real risk with ACs in accommodation blocks. That's something else that would supplement revenues going forward. You know, when I talked about mosques, for example, we're talking purely about power. Water is as big a concern in the Middle East, and we can monitor and control that to a similar-ish degree as well. So what I would say is we have to focus on achieving, and then everything else is another opportunity on top.
Very good. So how big is the opportunity in Aramco? What are they looking to do? You know, do you anticipate that McDonald's will extend in terms of become bigger? And, you know, these mosques, I mean, there are literally thousands of mosques that could use this process. So, you know, again, my first question was, how many numbers of units do we think we need to get to achieve these numbers that I discussed with you?
If I was to take, I will take a theoretical case. Well, not a theoretical case, but maybe a practical one. Let's just say that we put a unit in that a customer paid $4,000 a year for, so $20,000 over 5 years. After commissions, cost of deployment and everything, I would expect an operating margin, not an EBITDA margin, of in excess of 50%. So when you look at, you have an operating cost base at the moment that, you know, you can see for the financials is probably a couple of million pounds. Let's push to $3 million a year. If you can look at an operating contribution, let alone an EBITDA contribution, of a minimum of $2,000 per unit, you can see you don't need that many.
You're being evasive and not answering my question, but I like it.
Well, I'm not being evasive per se, because break-evens, you have to make a number of assumptions. So, for example, there are territories where we will sell a unit at $6,500 for a specific need. There are others where it might be $3,000. But if I took $2,000 a unit and said I had a cost base of $3 million to cover, that's what, 1,500 units to break even? And to get to $10 million profit, that's another 6,000 units, 6,500. So you can take it from there.
Okay, I'm with you. Okay, so how do you see those units and the achievement of those units occurring over the next year or two?
I think the magical point of where we're at is we've done the very, very hard yards with the customers. So if I was to look at some of them, it's a question of, we want the first 30 now. We have an estate of 1,000 that we wish to roll out. Now, the one thing I can never guarantee is the speed of customers. And for those who work in the Middle East, you know, there are two speeds, one where you can't talk for a week, and then the other one of, why didn't you get it done yesterday? And at the moment, I'm finding with customers that I'm moving into the, why haven't you got it done yesterday? So we then get down to the speed of our deployment. As I said earlier, we now have the background and capability to deliver volumes where we can turn a tap on fairly quickly with our contract manufacturer. We have a capability where we've developed to allow us to actually be able to use people to outsource and deliver. So I'm very comfortable with the financial plan and the numbers you were talking about in terms of the number of units growth that we can achieve. Could we run faster than that? Quite possibly. But yes, I don't see the growth as being a problem, because every single one of our customers isn't just a 50, it's a 500 or multiple thousands. And, you know, to take the example of mosques, as you said, there's probably between 1,000 and 2,000 addressable mosques in Qatar. There's 10,000 within UAE, and there's 130,000 per hour, well, the channel partner we're signing up with in KSA. And in that case, what we've done is we've had to work with the government body, and it's a government body's placing the order. And obviously, once you have one of those, the look through is very, very powerful.
Indeed. No, it sounds fascinating. What else merely can these systems do? And, you know, we talked about water, gas. What else can they do from a technical point of view?
So where we are going with this is what I'll say. You asked Bill the question, in 2 years or 3 years, what are you looking at? One of the key areas we are working towards is, and we believe will happen, is there is going to be a change in how energy is going to be delivered. Because as you see increasing amounts of renewables on the grid, you're beginning to see that your supply side is not as dispatchable as it used to once be, or you can't be extremely sure. So people are looking at different aspects. We're looking at each one of our gateways as a node that helps manage the flow of energy across different loads. So I could look at a facility like a Dubai port, which has several facilities within it. And we basically are able to manage the energy requirements for that and actually create something where, in the old times, it used to be that the supply used to be fairly something that you could depend on and plan on, but the loads used to vary. We can flip that by saying that we can actually start forecasting loads much ahead of time, and so that the supply can be planned a lot better. And that's something that we're working on, where we can interconnect our gateways together and get that information. That's something very, very unique. And that's something that needs a lot of, that's where a lot of our work is going in terms of how we take our AI models and deploy them on edge, meaning on the gateway itself, so that they can start making decisions on how energy is sent from one area to the other and how it manages that flow of energy. So that's something very unique that we are doing. And that's something we will be developing at a pretty significant pace. But in addition to that, in a shorter term, what we've found is that even the way we measure the energy or other parameters, there are things that we are improving upon. So we will be developing something fairly soon that gives us a lot more depth of data. So our goal is to keep digging deeper and deeper in. And what you realize is we start getting these huge data lakes, which are appropriate to help us with training our AI models. Nobody else has this depth of data to train them. So your AI model is as good as the data that you're feeding to train it. And we are doing that, where we're getting deeper and deeper and collecting that data. And that's why, when I said earlier, our platform is unique, because not only are we looking at the analysis and analytics and the algorithms, but also the hardware, because they work off each other and they keep making it something that we are doing, digging deeper and deeper, what we call intrusive data. That's something that's very unique. And that's you could say, the secret to how we expand into all these other opportunities that we're looking at.
So you perceive there's a really deep value within the data that you're collecting, and not just the actual process of putting these in. You're going to get smarter and smarter at this, I presume?
Yeah.
What I would also just say here is at the moment we're talking about data being used by a customer to improve their operations. There's also an opportunity where if you think about the OEMs, what's that data worth to them? How do they know how their equipment really performs in the field? You know, and you then look at it in terms of patterns of predicting use. If you're a utility, having this level of information to predict supply, et cetera, et cetera. So I think what I would say, and I didn't wish to cut across Murali, is that at the moment, we're probably only using the data for about 20, 25% of its use. And these are other areas that we can certainly look at. As the data lake gets bigger, it becomes much more appealing.
Yeah. And Murali, if I ask you again, you know, from the subcontinent of India, are they going to have enough electricity in the future? Because, I mean, you've got 1.3 billion people there, all going to be starting to use more appliances as time goes by. Is there enough electricity?
No. And that's another interesting topic you talk about. So if you look at the per capita consumption of energy in India, it's about 1,000 units. And the global average is somewhere around 4,000. For us to go from 1,000 to 4,000, you're talking about quadrupling our current, if everything stays the same, quadrupling it.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of coal burnt, isn't there?
Yeah. So, and we don't have that much coal. So if you look at, what I look at is for any country, it's not just India, any country. If you look at what I call sustainable energy, then you have three aspects, what I call the three E's: energy security, emissions, and economics. You have to make these three work for you to have a sustainable future. I mean, energy security is one important piece in this whole equation, is where you're going to get your energy from. So there is something, where you're going to harvest your energy from. Is it the wind, the sun? They are what I call non-dispatchable sources. When they blow, and you have to build your system for that. And then you have what you call the environment. So they are driving people to make certain decisions. India definitely needs, in one way I say, India could be also one of the first countries to disrupt the whole energy market. It's not there yet, but necessity will drive that. And that's something very similar to what happened with mobile telephony in India. And the growth of mobile telephony is something that everyone across the globe knows. And you see all the different apps and different processes that have come in with that. And that's something very similar we expect to see with energy. And when I talked about mini grids and micro grids, that's something that that's why we are focusing on that, because that would be something that allows us to create these islands where we can locally source a lot of the energy and help manage it better. And the grid becomes more of a support for it. And how we manage that is what we're doing. And this data that we're collecting is actually helping us build that base. So we are building it ground up as well as top down, whereas most people don't have access to this level of data. So they kind of look at it from a more higher level, saying, yeah, this, we need something like this. What people are thinking, I think, is something we are able to see how we can implement those.
Very good. So there are multi-channels in this in terms of, yes, you're going to save electricity. Yes, you're going to produce a huge amount of data, which is going to be of value as well. Yes, you've got a SaaS business, which effectively people are paying they're paying a small amount for the box, but ultimately it's a monthly renewing or annually renewing over 5 years product. So you've probably built up a fair amount of revenue already, even in the ones that you've got, that is going to come over the next 5 years. And if this is scaled, like, it's off the chart what this could be worth. I mean, it really is. I mean, and I'm sure you believe that. But I'm looking at it and going, I only discovered this company a couple of days ago because we were speaking to Ashish. You know, to me, this is an off-the-scale opportunity. You're not on the stock market at the minute. You need to raise £3 million. And then basically after that, you're probably not going to need a great deal of cash. You're going to then patent the thing, put yourself in a position where it should just be producing money. Now, the interesting thing, I think, that though you can look at the basic business, is this data could end up be worth more than everything combined. You know, businesses are going to want to pay for this data to make their businesses, you know, even if they don't use your tech, they want to use the data to help them save billions, literally, in costs. So, yeah, it's all very exciting.
We've always believed that point. Sorry, Kevin, because when you look at it, I mean, even crazy things. So we have put this in Residences Anonymized, and it's amazing the information that you get, because people don't realize your mobile phone with GPS tells people an awful lot of what you're doing. Your power use tells them what you're doing inside your house almost. Now, I don't mean that in terms of being intrusive and spying, but in terms of the information for businesses to be able to plan. The data to us ultimately is always the biggest value of this business on top of the actual execution and delivery. So I think you just summed that up brilliantly. Thank you.
You're welcome. Phil's got a question for you now.
Well, yeah, I guess you're on the Sunday roast, and it's a bit of a left field question, but what is the perfect roast in the, well, start with you, Bill. What is your perfect Sunday roast?
Oh, I'm very, very traditional. I mean, in my household, I'm the person who has to cook it. Well, my kids say I make the world's best roast potatoes, and actually now they're adults. It's one of the few reasons they come home.
Brilliant.
So very, very traditional. Lots of Yorkshire pudding, lots of roast potatoes, and a very good joint. It's in the family. I'm still a red meat fan. Most of them prefer white meat.
Yeah. So what's the key to the, I mean, I'm very much let the potatoes boil and almost fall so you get them really crispy because they fluff up. Like, what is your key to getting the perfect roast potato?
I'm not entirely sure. I would probably say having an arga.
Okay.
Having an arga and getting temperamental, because it's always the last 10 minutes when they come out fine, and in the meantime being slightly neurotic.
I like it. And Murali, what is the Sunday roast out in Bangalore?
I'm not sure I would say roast. I'm a vegetarian.
Okay.
So I
not
go
roast, with, not roast.
Not roast, but a good dosa is something I really enjoy, and the whole family enjoys. And I do manage to make a decent dosa.
Brilliant. Love a dosa.
Very good. I've never actually visited India, so I'd love to come out and
you
see it.
You've got to go. It's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah.
Murali and I met. We worked together there for 3 or 4 years.
Very good. Very good. Well, guys, we look forward to following your journey over the next period of time. Anyway, I think you've got a fantastic business, and I think you've done the hard yards as we've discussed through this. Now it's about scaling it up. As you scale this up, I can't see how it won't be beneficial to the world, but extremely beneficial to shareholders. So, yeah.
Yep.
Good luck.
Yeah, Bill and Murali of Ricana Energy, thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of the week. The best performer I make on SharePad is Cloudbreak Discovery, up some 100%. They announced that they'd exercised the option to acquire phase one of their 60 square kilometres Darlow West Gold Project in Western Australia, located 10 kilometres southwest of the 2.8 million ouncing producing Darlow gold mine. And they'd also completed the latest phase of exploration there. So market really liked that one.
Does that give you feelings of reminiscence?
I know. I mean, it's one of the first companies that we actually worked with was, Kyla Hardy back in the day. I mean, this has changed massively. They started off more as, I mean, they're still doing the same kind of royalty generator model, but the fact that Western Australia is mentioned is just propelling the share price.
Yeah,
I mean,
it was Canada, 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 wasn't it?
No,
it wasn't just Canada, if I remember back then. Who's in charge now then, do you know?
Yeah, I believe is it Tom running it now? It's no one related to the business as we knew it. Like, you know, they've not got the Rory and the guys there. It's generally moved out to a new CEO. But yeah, definitely interesting seeing that one move. Oracle Power up some 56% on the week. And actually, we've got a late comer to the movers now, because this stock has literally gone off. They were trading around 2.35 on close on Thursday. And then Friday, during the recording of this, they had effectively a document was posted on the government website. And it's Energy Pathways. They're up some 166%. And actually, it's the document, I think it was shared, wasn't it, in one of the Telegram groups and online, basically stating that the government had effectively signed off the project at the mesh project there. I've not actually really studied it in a massive amount of detail, But the decision to issue the direction, the Secretary of State is of the opinion that direction should be issued because the proposed development is of national significance, taking into account the proposed scale of its outputs. And the proposed development could play an important role in enabling an energy system that meets UK commitment to reduce carbon emissions, and progressing the proposed development through the Planning Act of 2006 development onsets process would provide the certainty of a single unified consenting process and fixed timescale. So that stock is now trading, Energy Pathways is now trading up some 140 to 157%.
How much is EPP worth now it's got that? And with that, have it's the other license.
11 million cap at 5.6 pence currently trading as we speak. And it's
got to be worth 20, 30 million pounds minimum.
Yeah.
Minimum. It's got to be 10, 15, 20p. Now that basically got the stamp of approval, the money's going to come, as Ben mentioned in the past before. And they're going to get a storage license now as well because they've got the S35. Like, it's a no-brainer. I don't know. Everyone's going to be thinking, oh, it's just gone up a lot, but it hasn't. It's only back to where it was.
I mean, you've got to remember that we were in double digits. We were in double digits on far less progression at that point, weren't we? The market has been very harsh on that. And actually, it should be probably trading around the double digits.
Yeah, without doubt. I mean, it's a no-brainer. That one should be flying.
12p on the sort of just on the muting of news. So so that was interesting to see. The other one was on the week we've had Oracle Power, as I said, up some 56%. Again, there's no significant news, but I think there's just talk of a potential license approval. Defence Holdings up 40% on the week, the gift that keeps on giving. Obviously, they announced on Friday that they would hold a live broadcast interview with the incoming non-exec chairman.
Have to wear our army uniforms when that interview comes out?
Yeah, I think that's on Friday. That's on a week
next
today.
Friday.
So Friday the 3rd, that's going to be on live on X, formerly Twitter, with a recording later available on the company's Investor Hub. James Baker will host the interview with Lord Houghton's first public remarks since his appointment, covering his military career, insights into modern defence leadership, the role of AI and cyber. So really, really good appointment, that one, the Field Marshal Lord Houghton of Richmond. And it'll be very interesting to hear his comments on that
one. If you really believe that that's going to be the palantir of the United Kingdom, then it's cheap as chipstone. You know, it's again another one that if the government is really backing this thing through the MOD, which it seems to be, then it's going to be worth hundreds of millions, I'm sure of it. Maybe even much bigger than
maybe
that.
Even more. We've actually met over a pound, firmly into the pound territory. What do you make of that, the moves on Guardian?
It was sort of inevitable, wasn't it? It was going to happen. I just feel like it blasted up, didn't it, into the 90s, and then settled down, and then it's just gone back. The buy-in seems to be more on the OTC than it is in the UK now, or at least level pegging. So as the Americans start to get more and more interested, I can only see it going up. I mean, my view is, and it may be on the plane, even £2-3 is what it's going to be worth at a minimum. If you want a nice steady one from here, I think it's going to do very well. What were your thoughts of Amazing AI after listening to him?
Yeah, I like it. I mean, I really like that we drilled down into Paul's background as a kind of like, I love the story about him, a 12-year-old sort of being this entrepreneur, selling these discs and sort of like these games and being really entrepreneurial. And then eventually being, even at the age of 14, trading stocks and not just trading them in a sort of, you know, buy, trade, flip way, but actually doing derivatives and you know, puts, call options, you know, that sort of thing. It's very technical. And as I say, his CV with, you know, over 30 years in the finance, Ernst & Young Award for Young Entrepreneur of the Year in 2007. Very, very, very interesting. And I think that if he can do what he says he can in terms of the way he's going to leverage and derivative trade the likes of Ethereum and, you know, Bitcoin, I think that that will be trading at many multiples of where we are right now in the coming sort of, you know, year, 18 months.
Yeah, I think it could be much quicker than that. But yes, I agree with you 100%. I think that my definition of it was SWC on steroids, right? That's what I think it's basically appealing. But, and this is the big but, the financing business that it has behind it, I believe, is probably conservatively worth 3 to 5 times current market cap. So the 5 million he's got that's going to be lent out at 59.5% with a 30% margin is going to be worth considerably more than the current market capitalization. That's my view. So in my view, his other tactics are a shot to nothing, because effectively, if they work, the profit's going to be in the tens, if not hundreds of millions.
Yeah, the other one this week, Priority Intelligence, had an RNS on Friday, basically just talking about the fact that they'd launched this new Fan Sonar, which is an AI-powered social listening tool that analyzes brand impact across 100 million plus online sources. This SaaS product integrates with clients' feeds to train the AI models, delivering contextual insights on sentiment, buying intent, emotion, topic trends, and influencer activity in near real time, enhanced by Capitano for cross-channel analysis. Targeting a share of that $7.6 billion social listening market, FanSonar provides small to medium enterprises with an affordable alternative to costly legacy tools, with rollout already underway and the ability to access up to 10 years of historical brand data. Sounds like a very, very interesting plug-in to the services.
Yeah, absolutely. The other one that we saw news about was, and we're speaking with Rory this afternoon, actually, and there's going to be some interviews next week with Rory and also the Chief Technical Officer, Daniel Gee. Also, the one that saw some movement on this week was Buccaneer Energy. They had the pegging out so that they can spud that well, which is going to happen in the next couple of weeks, I think, which will increase their production up again. We had some news on Chill. Chill basically giving some shares to Jonathan Swan for the cash that he was owed on interest. There's all sorts of rumors going about that they're going to raise. I don't think they are. I was with Callum this week and I don't see it happening. But anyway, I think there's a lot of things going on and hopefully he's going to update the market. He was talking about next week. So hopefully maybe we'll get him on next week. I mean, there's lots of other things. The other one was Sylvanas. Sylvanas
had a lot of trading activity. Current trading is 0.368 to buy. It definitely went higher than that on the Friday. There was some 0.38, 0.39 trades. You're absolutely right.
But it's more the volume. I can see Immu Pharma type go on that one, you know, on the basis that, you know, he's openly said now he's going to get a deal within the next few months. You know, the deal was to be to have a deal in 2025, exactly the same as Immu Pharma. And it's at the same sort of low valuation as Immu Pharma was. It's worth a bit more, but not significantly more. And I can see it going on a run because it seems to be that these pharma bioplay things, like when they go, you know.
Yeah.
So we'll see on that.
Let's have a look.
I mean, there's obviously plenty more to talk about, but I mean, we'll leave it at that, I think, for now. And there was an interview done during the week on Coin that was, you know, worth a listen. You should have a listen of that. I thought it was very good. And if you want a Bitcoin play that is a bit more, you know, just on the Bitcoin side of things with the potential for upside, I thought that was pretty good. And we participated in that. So we'll see how it all goes.
Then you've got gold trading at 37.49 currently and silver at 45.0.
Yeah, what did I say? Silver at 30 9 months ago. I tell you, it's happening. It's happening. And it hasn't. I think it's going to go to 55.60 is my view. Because it's just steadily going every day, every week. It's just up a dollar, up half a dollar. It's just creeping up because it's that the gold-silver ratio is still crazy. It's still like 85, you know, which is way above what it should be. You know, it was over 100. It's coming down a bit now. But really, gold-silver ratio of 60 to 70 would still be over the top. But that would put silver at about $60.
Good. Well, I think on that note, we'll say, you know, thanks for listening. If you like what you've heard, please do hit the bell icon and subscribe for any further notifications of future episodes. And have a great weekend all.
Yep. Thanks for listening, guys. I hope you enjoyed the off-market company, Rakana. I think it's got massive potential. And if anybody is interested in that, slip us your name and number or contact us. And we'll pass it on to the right people.
Okay, good. Have a great weekend, all.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.